Jane Caro, Susan Windham, it's great to have you here at Booktopia on this very auspicious day, the 14th of July, very appropriate day to talk about the Rebellious Daughters anthology, to which you are both contributors, as indeed am I. So I want to start by asking you both, when you were first approached to be in this anthology, what were your initial thoughts about rebellion generally, even before you kind of formulated what you might write, Jane?
Well, I thought it was a really intriguing subject, and I thought, well, I love the idea of rebellion, I love subversion, I love all of that. But then I had to be honest with myself and think, but when I was a teenager, I wasn't particularly rebellious. I was mildly, kind of calculatingly rebellious. Rebellious enough to have fun but not to get caught. You know, that kind of yes. Nasty little sneak, basically. I was a very, very accomplished liar as a teenager, unlike some of my siblings who got caught. So, I had to think quite hard about what tack I'd take, and I ended up taking one that I think is different from everybody
else. Yes, it is. We'll come back to that in a moment. What about you, Susan?
Well, I thought it was a wonderful idea for a book and one that I had no place in because I was probably the least rebellious daughter that I could imagine because my mother and I were very close. We lived together alone as a divorced mother and only child. And I was a very good girl. And I suppose I was a bit like Jane at school. I was a bit of a sneak in that I was good, I was attentive, I was so anxious that I didn't miss anything at school. And I did well at school. But I would do things like when the teacher was out of the room, I'd jump up and write on the blackboard, "Sir Jerry Plastic is a plastic surgeon." That was my version of graffiti. And I was never caught. My friend was caught who did it with me. And when the teachers found out it was me, they said, "Susan Windham?" And they didn't get the joke anyway. So, you know, my attempts at rebellion were hopeless. But when I thought more about myself, I realised that there was this one period in my adolescence where my mother and I had suddenly butted heads over sex.
Yeah, well,
and I thought I have a story.
Is a kind of the classic theme really in this anthology. It's one of the great sort of propellers of rebellion in adolescence, isn't it? I mean, it's when all the sort of assertion of self and kind of power struggle with the previous generation kind of comes to the fore. And that's one of the pleasures, I think, in reading this book is to sort of remind yourself of your own sort of hormonal surges in that direction. But don't you think that, Jane, for you, before we even get to what you've written about here, because as you say, you've gone about it from a sort of different perspective, that you have, in a sense, grown into your rebellion, that you have become... As you've become older, you've become more rebellious.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I'm not sure why that is. I don't know whether it's a growth in confidence, no longer seeking approval in the way that I did. I mean, I was the eldest of four. I was very close to both my parents, and my mother in particular relied upon me as an almost support system as she dealt with my younger brothers and sisters and just the sheer effort of looking after a family that I don't think she ever intended to have that many children. And so I kind of didn't get to rebel all that much when I was young, as I said before. And I think as I've grown older and I've stopped worrying about getting approval and I've stopped worrying about being a support system for other people, I have grown more into myself. And there is something fundamentally rebellious about a woman that doesn't see her primary role as a support person for someone else. Mm. That is essentially rebellious.
Absolutely. Susan, you were talking before about your very close relationship with your mother. I guess, you know, it's different, isn't it, when you are an only child, you and I have that in common, that you have such a kind of strong intimacy with your parents. You are so much closer because of being the centre of attention, because of being the only one. And so you've turned that around in a very interesting way into a kind of rivalry, I guess, isn't it, with your mother, this very attractive, quite charismatic woman who was still in her own sexual prime as you were discovering yours.
Yes, I see it as us entering a kind of adolescence together at the same time.
Exactly.
Because my mother had been divorced when she was very young. She'd been out with men but never really had a man she cared about while I was growing up. And she dedicated herself to bringing me up. I think she felt she had to be mother, father, breadwinner, everything. And she was a wonderful mother and we were great friends, very close. And I felt a kind of responsibility for her too. I felt I had to protect her. So it was a mutually dependent and loving and responsible relationship right up until hormones hit. And, you know, Mum was in her 40s. I was about, I suppose, 14 when this period began. And she was suddenly thinking, oh, perhaps I can have a life too. And she met a man who she fell head over heels in passion and lust with. I think it was love, but it was a lot of lust. And it just bowled her over. And, you know, whatever she was planning to do, this took over. At the same time, I had, as I write in my piece, I had really fallen in love with a young man when I was 11. And it didn't turn into anything more than that until I was 15 or 16. But it was always there as the man that I could have because I didn't have a father, because my mother was turning away from me. So it became a really strong attraction for me to have this other sort of emotional anchor in my life. And of course I was going out with other boys, I was reading about sex, it was in the air, it was the 1970s for heaven's sake, sex was everywhere. And we were both breaking out of a more conservative time in our lives. So it was a really interesting and, as you say, rivalrous sort of relationship that developed, where we never hated each other. Neither of us ever said, I hate you, get out of my life, but we were in competition and in conflict for quite a few years.
I think you've really treated that very subtly and with a lot of nuance, and I've never read a sort of mother-daughter kind of relationship with quite the dynamic that you've described.
I should point out, we were never in competition over the same man.
Thank
or boy.
God.
There wasn't that element.
It's complicated.
Now, Jane, you have addressed this whole subject from the point of view not of being writing as a daughter, but writing as a mother, and interestingly, with two daughters who rebelled in different ways. So what made you want to tackle this subject from that point of view?
Because there was a part of me, it's part of my natural, these days, subversiveness, and I thought, you know, I want to represent the other point of view in this book, which is of those women, and to a lesser extent fathers, who get rebelled against, who for a period of time or forever get rejected in some way. There's just a part of me that always is interested in the villain of the piece.
Yes.
And I saw an opportunity because I thought, well, I was the villain in the piece. I mean, I was the mother whose daughters are found on many levels difficult to live with for a long period of time. I equally found them fairly difficult to live with. And I wanted to put that point of view, that it's not always these wonderful young women going off into the world and leaving the sort of dried up old husk of their, you know, mother behind. That's more complicated than that.
And I think you also make the point, don't you, that not all rebellion is noisy. I mean, some is very feisty and loud and violent, but there is also the stealthy, quiet rebellion.
The cold. One of my daughters rebelled in a really hot, when you said you never said I hate you, well, that was said to me on a daily basis by one daughter, along with a whole lot of other less printable expressions. And yet I found her rebellion in many ways easier to cope with because it was all up in the window. It was emotional.
Yes.
It was, you could hold on to it in some way. But my younger daughter, she saw how that worked out, and so she went a different route and she withdrew. So I could have no, I felt I was out of contact with her and I couldn't get close to her. Mm. I would just hit this brick wall. And that, you see, as an added responsibility, you know, you said as a daughter you felt protective of your mother. When you're a mother, society expects you. It's not just you feel protective. You know, that is your whole job. And if you feel you're failing at it, there's so many layers to that guilt and self-questioning and self-pity, as it turned out in my case as a mother, that I was not particularly conscious of or doing very well. But there's so many layers to how you feel as a mother. And, of course, I thought I was a terrific mother and I thought I was really open and, you know, what would they have to rebel against? Well, I was an idiot, really, wasn't I?
Did you ever do that thing that I have heard some mothers do? I have to say my mother hasn't done it, of apologising to your daughters and saying, I'm sorry if I wasn't the mother that you needed me to be?
That's interesting. I haven't... I mean, I've said to them on many occasions, look, you know, I was... the only mother I knew how to be, and that there were good bits in that and there were bad bits in that, but that's all you're going to get, a human being. So I don't feel a need to apologise for it, because I did my best. It's never going to be perfect, but can you imagine having a perfect parent? How terrible that would be.
Well, there is
that's
no
something
such
to
thing.
Rebel against.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
But my youngest daughter did sideways apologise to me. We were at an event a few years ago now, and she was standing next to me with her arm around my shoulders, which was something that a few years beforehand I would have stood frozen and not dared move, because it was such a rare thing to happen. And she was talking to a friend of ours, and she started to talk about and say things like, I was really horrible to my mother when I was a teenager. I'm not quite sure why I was so horrible to her. You know, I look back on it now. And I stood there and thought, oh, this is for my benefit, even though it's going sideways. So I got a really interesting insight into the way she's thought about it since.
It's interesting that you mention that, because in this anthology I write about a very late on rebellion, which took place when I was in my 40s, and I became estranged from my parents for 3 years. And when we subsequently were reconciled, in that reconciliation there was no apology. It was never discussed. We managed to move on, and I think we all realized that if we ventured into the terrain of apology, we would go sliding back into blame, and that it was just better to be grateful for the fact that after 3 years of estrangement, which is very painful when you're an only child, that we could find a way to rebuild and move on. Whereas apology sometimes means that you've got to go back and re-examine the entrails, and none of us wanted to do that.
But Carol, you were the one who made the gestures of peace to your parents. It wouldn't have happened without you, and I think that was partly a function of you being an adult by the time this happened.
You do get to the point with your rebellion where you do wonder what the end game is. You know, you think, what's the point here? And you do have to ask yourself, okay, if they died tomorrow, would I have this on my conscience? You know, I'm still torn about this. I think estrangement is a very, very interesting subject, because in the past, before I did it myself, before I broke off with my parents, I was very judgmental of people who did it. I thought that they were hard-hearted, they were selfish, they were uncaring. Having done it myself, I now understand why some people do have to walk away from toxic relationships, and there is nothing else. If as a party, they will not go and get professional help, sometimes I think that is the best thing you can do. But I am really, really glad in my case that I was able to reconcile, because it meant that when the next chapter of life unfurled, with my father becoming very ill demented, I could be there to help.
Yeah.
But you rebelled against a lifetime of being a good daughter, didn't you?
Well, that's partly why I relate very well to what you were saying about being the sort of good girl, because I was at my French school, on the reports for me, it always said, Caroline est sage comme une image. Caroline is as good as a picture. So obviously, you know, it was very, very late when my friends used to say to me, when are you going to rebel? When are you going to have the kind of revolt against the status quo that we've all been through? And I never wanted to or knew how.
Do you think that, because you're both only children, do you think this is part of the difficulty of being an only child, in that the relationship is more intense with your parents, there is more responsibility on you?
You do have a sense that I'm the only one, so I better not fuck up. Did you have that feeling?
Very much. I think it was in my nature too. I was a fairly placid child, but I do think you think of your parent, or I did, more as a person.
Yeah.
Rather than ganging together with the kids against the parents.
I think you also have a sense of their investment in you, that there is no spare. And I think that that's also captured, funnily enough, I don't think that's unique to us, and that's really brought out for me in this anthology, by the cultural traditions of, say, the Chinese mother. Mm. So in the contributions from, say, a writer like Michelle Law, you get a sense of this very claustrophobic, stifling upbringing with lots of rules, where, you know, a breakout rebellion can be something as simple as wanting to go for a bike ride. You know, it doesn't have to be wanting to go and, you know, sleep with a boy. It can be something as basic as just being able to cycle somewhere on your own.
I think there is another thing too, and one of my problems with writing it from the perspective of a rebellious daughter is that my parents, a bit like me, were quite were not controlling. They were, they, you know, there was a lot of things that you were allowed to do. And so to rebel, if you're going to rebel, you have to really ramp up what it is you're going to do, because there's very little that they actually disapprove of. You know,
I've met your parents, and they are very easygoing, very nice people, and they seem to me very sane. So I can imagine the difficulty you would have had.
You had to find something really, and I wasn't prepared to go to that length. I did have a sibling who did. But my own daughters found their own ways of putting my husband and I on the back foot. And I think you said, what's the end game here? What's the point? When I look at it from the perspective of a parent, what was the point of my daughters doing that? It really was them drawing a boundary between who they were and who I was and who my husband was, and how to differentiate, separate from that projection of you as a person, which a parent inevitably has.
So do you think, Jane, that in fact generationally it's harder to rebel when you've got parents who will let you sleep with your boyfriend at home, let you smoke dope at home? I mean, really, post-70s, what parents would allow their children to do suddenly expanded so much. So many of the rules kind of fell away in a certain kind of, you know, boho, middle class kind of household. So do you think for this generation of young girls growing up now, that rebellion is going to be even harder for them because in a way society has relaxed so much?
I think that there's certainly going to be an element of that, though we seem to have bred a generation of highly anxious, perfectionist, driven young women who seem to feel that unless they are positively perfect in every possible way, they are a failure. And this terrifies me because it's such a burden on them. And also, I'm sorry to tell them this, it makes them dreadfully dull. It really does.
That's a really interesting note there, which we're sort of throwing a challenge out here, aren't we, to the next generation of young women, is be bold, don't strive to be perfect, and there's nothing wrong with being a troublemaker because it might actually be the thing that makes you grow as a person.
And don't you think these things are cyclical anyway? I think children of baby boomers who sort of threw away marriage and convention, the kids suddenly all wanted to have big white weddings and all of that.
True.
And in a way, my rebellion against my very liberal and generous mother was a fairly conservative one, because I found my man early and I stuck with him against all odds, whereas my mother hadn't had a man in her life. So I do think that children react against whatever their parents were. They will always find a way to rebel. So maybe this anxious generation will produce, I hope not a more anxious generation, but a sort of what the hell, laid back, let's let it all hang out kind of generation of children. You can't tell.
No, and you know, you're right. There is reacting against, but then there's coming back, because, you know, the same girls who kicked over the traces with me so thoroughly and really spectacularly well in when they were like 15, 16, 17, are now, you know, very much partnered up. The eldest has a daughter, has a son, you know, that she's a pillar of the community. They're both pillars of the community. And in fact, I met my husband, and like you, I'm still with him, you know, when I was 18. Well, Polly met Adam when she was 17. Charlotte met David when she was 18, and they're still together. So there is the rebellion, and then there is the sort of ability, in a way, to be yourself, but also be like. You know, if you haven't made that separation, maybe you have to be as different from your parents as you possibly can be, because you're still fighting not to get kind of sucked into being like them. But if you've actually drawn those lines really clearly, I am not you and you are not me, then you've got more freedom. You can decide whether you want to be like them in some ways or not like them in some ways.
I'm thinking now about this book in a whole different way, which is that in a way the next generation of young women can look to rebellious daughters as a sort of primer for ideas. If they're at a loose end for how to rebel,
yes,
they can check in here and find all sorts of different ways. My favourite, one of my favourites in here is a hilarious story by Lee Kaufman about taking her mother to a sexpo show, which is not something that I would ever have thought of doing. But there are 17 stories in here from a very wide variety of women from a wide cross-section of ages and backgrounds. And as I said, here we are on the 14th of July, a very auspicious day to be talking about it. So thank you very much, Susan Windham and Jane Carrow, and long live the revolution.
Thanks, Caroline.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.